Hi, this is Mike Crawley. You're listening to the Run to the Top podcast.
Hello, fellow runners. I'm your host, Finn Melanson, and this is the Run to the Top podcast, the podcast dedicated to making you a better runner with each and every episode. We are created and produced by the expert team of coaches at runnersconnect.net, where you can find the best running information on the internet, as well as training plans to fit every runner and every budget. Why does it make sense to Ethiopian runners to get up at 3 a.m. to run up and down a hill? Who would choose to train on almost impossibly steep and rocky terrain in hyena territory? And how come Ethiopian men hold 6 of the top 10 fastest marathon times ever? Michael Crawley spent 15 months in Ethiopia training alongside, and sometimes a fair way behind, runners at all levels of the sport, from night watchmen hoping to change their lives to world-class marathon runners, in order to answer these questions. And in this episode of the Run to the Top podcast, we dig into those insights from his experiences and learn how they can apply to athletes at all stages of their running journey. I'd also like to introduce you to a new sponsor of the show, Timeline Nutrition. Timeline has developed a groundbreaking product called MitoPure that actually revitalizes your mitochondria, which create energy in nearly every cell in your body. Later in the episode, I'll explain the science and how you can get a sweet discount. All right, Mike Crawley, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First question that I want to ask you after reading your book, Out of Thin Air. I think a lot of listeners are somewhat familiar with Kenyan running culture, and oftentimes everyone else in the region gets lumped into this category of East African. Can you talk broadly about what makes Ethiopian running culture unique in that area?
Yeah, sure. Just to kind of expand a little bit on what you've just said, I think that what has tended to happen, is people have referred to the East Africans generally. Most people have gone to Kenya just because, you can speak English in Kenya. There's some pretty comfortable hotels in Iten. Ethiopia is a little bit slightly more difficult to access, I suppose, because the language is tricky, Amharic, and runners tend to live in the capital city, but then take buses all around to train. So I do think we tend to make assumptions based on Kenyan running and then apply them to other East African countries, even though there's this huge kind of cultural variation between different people. In Ethiopia, so the main kind of differences, I guess, or the things that I found surprising when I first got there, I suppose, were people were very invested in this communal idea about what success was. So there was this idea that training had to be a collective process. It was very important to be embedded within a group. And so the first thing that happened to me when I got there is I started running in the forest on my own, and I was basically grabbed by this group of guys who were running past in a kind of single file line. And they said, training alone is just, you can train alone if you want, but that's just something that people do for health. If you want to be transformed as an athlete, you've got to run with other people. So that was kind of really impressed on me early on, that this was something that was very important to people, this idea that you could kind of improve as a group and things. Other things that were surprising were the fact that people, these are some of the very best marathon runners in the world. So the group I was in ranged from sort of 206 maybe to 210, 211 marathon runners. Wasn't one of the very top groups, actually, but these are, guys who are operating on a very high level. They only ran on the road once a week max. They were very keen to stress that it was important to avoid kind of firm surfaces at all costs. They said that the kind of asphalt surface killed your legs and that you lose your speed completely if you train too much on the road. So a lot of what we were doing there was kind of finding the right kind of set of surfaces and environments to train in that they thought would lead to improvement as an athlete. So it was a lot about kind of how to position yourself within the environment in order to improve. So I guess that's a slightly different way of thinking about things to the way that we might think about it in the West as well.
I love what you said there in particular about this communal idea of success. And I want to come back to that later in the conversation because I think it was such a major focal point of the book. But one other thing I loved about the book is how much you intersperse these sociological commentaries about how the running culture in Ethiopia has been built up. And one thing that stuck out, this is part question, part comment, from a historical standpoint, can you talk about why in the last, let's call it 40 to 50 years, their government and seemingly society as a whole has placed such an emphasis on this sport and provided outlets for people to, you know, rise up the ranks and train full time and race full time? Because it seems to me that if you compare the opportunities available to, say, a UK runner versus an Ethiopian runner, the latter is going to have a lot more institutional support, at least in the public sector. So maybe talk about why that's so special there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important thing to kind of get across as well, because we have this assumption based on some of the kind of media reporting on running in East Africa that, you know, runners are good because they ran barefoot to and from school out of necessity, and therefore they just kind of automatically became champion athletes. That's very much not the case. As you say, there's you know, really wide institutional support. In Kenya, athletics was basically introduced in a colonial context by the British. Ethiopia was not really like that. It was never kind of formally colonized in the same way. So the way that people got interested in athletics was that there was an army general or major in the army who came in to train the imperial bodyguard of Haile Selassie, who's the emperor. And he just sort of realized that some of the imperial bodyguard members were quite good at running, and he decided to coach them. Haile Selassie, as part of his kind of desire to frame Ethiopia as a more modern nation in the 60s, kind of got hold of this and was like, right, we're going to get Ethiopia into the Olympics and have some representation from distance runners. And then Abibi Bikila went to the Olympics in Rome in 1960 and won the marathon running barefoot. And that kind of sparked this huge amount of, national pride in Ethiopian running, which has then been, as you say, kind of supported by the government. So nowadays you have a whole tier of first division running clubs that are all supported by the local bank, the cement factory, the army, the prison service. And those institutions basically pay athletes a salary just to run full time. So technically, a lot of the guys in the professional group that I ran in were employees of the Ethiopian Electric Corporation. So they would go to the electric corporation for lunch in the canteen quite often alongside the people who worked for the electricity corporation. So there's this huge number of hundreds of athletes who are basically supported to run full time and to just make that all that they do. And then the domestic competitions between these clubs are really kind of fiercely contested. And then the best of those athletes then go abroad to race. So you've got this whole kind of very competitive domestic running scene in Ethiopia that I think a lot of people don't really know very much about as well.
I think it ties in again to this communal idea of success that you talked about earlier as well. One more thing I want to ask you about on that front. You noted that it is sort of a common misconception that it's the poorest who become the champion runners in the country. But at the same time, in the book, you note that there is this morality when it comes to work ethic that's tied to this memory of poverty and doing justice to a past self and not forgetting those circumstances. So can you reconcile those two things a bit more, or explain them at least?
It's a similar idea to, there's a sociologist called Loic Wacon who writes about boxing in Chicago. And he says, you know, it's not the people from the very poorest households are not going to be the ones that are producing boxers, because it's just too disordered a life. If you're really kind of just living completely hand to mouth, you're not going to be able to have the structure to become a boxer. It's kind of the same, I guess, in Ethiopia. It's not the very poorest households, but most of the athletes that I knew came from basically subsistence farming backgrounds. So their parents were farmers. They grew up in highland areas where that was, that's how they lived. A lot of people would say, until they moved to Addis and kind of joined a club, they hadn't really ever eaten anything that wasn't grown within eyesight of where they lived. So that you kind of people, yeah, really kind of living living off the land. And the way that people talked about wanting to become a runner was that they wanted to change their life. That was the way that everybody said, I want to change my life. I want to change the life for my family by making money. So it was kind of, yeah, very much an economic motivation. But usually the runners came from families where the families didn't necessarily want them to become a runner. They kind of would have preferred them to focus on education and other sort of routes towards success and improving their lives. But people had to kind of defend the right to become a runner against their families a lot of the time. But I hope that makes sense.
No, of course. One other thing that I don't want to overlook before we get more into the book is that you have this academic background. And I think it's always cool when we create these intersections between some sort of academic discipline like ethnography in our sport. And you note again early in the book that running and anthropology, for example, allow you to do a similar thing, live a whole other life. And that struck me as interesting. Can you talk more about that connection and what it means in detail?
Yeah, so ethnography, just for anybody who doesn't know, is the main kind of research method that anthropologists use, which is mainly a method of participant observation. So basically, the idea is that you spend a lot of time with the people that you're trying to write about in order to really get to know them and their kind of way of life in a really kind of in-depth, intimate way. So the way I did that was to spend 15 months basically living and training alongside a group of Ethiopian runners. And yeah, so I suppose fairly obviously ethnography is a way of living a whole other life, because I was completely, you know, in a new country, learning a new language, living with people I'd never met before. But yeah, I kind of think that running in a sense allows us to do that as well, because we have, you know, everything else that we have in our lives. And then running kind of offers us a whole other kind of set of aspirations, a whole different way of kind of escaping from the rest of what's going on, and a way to have this whole other narrative about what we're doing, I suppose. So I kind of just thought there was a slightly interesting kind of overlap between those two.
Right on. Maybe. Well, coming back to this idea, this theme of this communal idea of success, there were a lot of interesting contrasts between the East and the West in this book. And one that struck me was the fact that in Ethiopia, no one runs, no one trains alone. So can you talk, I have a lot of questions off this, but the first one is, can you talk about the cultural and performance rationales for why this is the case there?
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll start with the cultural side of it. Basically, people had this sense that that energy was sort of limited to a certain extent, that there was like, that there was only so much energy that you had access to as an athlete, and that it was kind of morally appropriate to train with other people so that everybody could keep an eye on what everybody else was doing. So it was, in some sense, there was a level of kind of suspicion about the way that some other people could train. So the idea was that it was important to basically be able to see what everybody else was doing and to expend energy equally so that everybody had a kind of equal opportunity to succeed. So it was seen as morally inappropriate to run on your own, especially if you ran on your own at night or kind of in a way that was seen as being kind of secretive. So I realized quite early on that it was going to be seen as really antisocial if I was to try and go for a run on my own. And then in terms of performance, this idea that this belief in kind of shared energy was even more pronounced, in that people would always train if they were running fast, in a kind of single file line, running very, very close to each other. And they would run in synchrony with each other. So, you know, right foot down, left foot down, everybody running in time, which I found very, very difficult to get used to at the beginning. But that was because there was people thought, it was kind of like with cycling and a peloton, I suppose. There was this very strong sense that whoever was at the front of the line was expending the most energy. So you would, whoever was leading would be kind of swapped in and out to make sure that this was kind of an equitable division of kind of running work, I suppose. But I think what it all comes down to really is this sense that people were really keen to make sure that they weren't overtraining. And the overtraining was the biggest danger for a group of people for whom running could potentially mean completely transforming their lives forever. Mm. You know, if you've got a chance to go to Dubai Marathon, which is almost always won by, you know, an 18-year-old Ethiopian who's not been abroad before, or and they win $200,000 suddenly. If you've got that kind of incentive, then it's very, very easy to overtrain, do too much. So a lot of the, I think a lot of this idea that you have to always train together is just to kind of rein people in and make sure there's a degree of control over making sure that people didn't do too much and run too quickly.
Stress is a common factor that affects everyone in today's fast-paced world, leading to various health issues, including heart problems, inflammation, obesity, and mental illness. While most people focus on finding relief through meditation or trips to the spa, what if the root cause of stress is actually a deficiency in a key nutrient? Introducing Magnesium Breakthrough, the ultimate magnesium supplement that offers the full spectrum of all seven types of magnesium, specially formulated to reach every tissue in your body for maximum health benefits. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could be causing a multitude of health problems. But what sets Magnesium Breakthrough apart is its ability to impact the release of stress hormones like cortisol and block the activity of more stimulating neurotransmitters, leading to a more peaceful and resting state. This means that this supplement acts like a brake on your body's nervous system, helping to calm and soothe, promoting a better quality of life. If you're interested to see just how much magnesium can help, simply go to magbreakthrough.com/run to the top and use the code RUN10. And for a limited time, if you buy 3 bottles, you can get exciting gifts with purchases like blue light blocking glasses and more. This is a limited time offer for select orders, so don't wait. Go now to magbreakthrough.com/run to the top. Improving your mitochondria is one of the easiest ways to upgrade your performance and make your body work better. My friends at Timeline Nutrition have introduced a product called MitoPure that is the ultimate tune-up for mitochondria. Timeline Nutrition's MitoPure is backed by over a decade of research and is clinically proven to revitalize mitochondria. As we know, mitochondria are the energy generators at the heart of nearly every cell in our body, but new science is shedding light on just how critical mitochondria are to our health and performance. For example, researchers found that mitochondria sound the alarm when cells are exposed to stress or chemicals that could damage DNA. Plus, as we age, eat too much, and sit at our desks too much, our mitochondria deteriorate and our bodies suffer. MitoPure restores mitochondrial function so every cell in your body has the energy to do its job and keep you healthy and functioning right. In fact, clinical studies have shown that 500 milligrams of urolithin, one of the main ingredients in MitoPure, can significantly increase muscle strength and endurance with no other change in lifestyle. MitoPure comes in powder form to mix into your favorite smoothie, protein powder if you're looking for a great 1-2 punch of muscle support, or soft gels. Improving your mitochondria is one of the best things you can do for your health, and with MitoPure from Timeline Nutrition, it has never been easier. So go to timelinenutrition.com and use promo code RUNNERSCONNECT for 10% off the plan of your choice. Just following up on what you said there about this whole, you know, preference towards training communally and all the gains that can be achieved from it. I'm curious, because in the West here, so in the UK, for example, in the United States, for example, I feel like a lot of athletes are biased towards this solo practitioner style of training and preparing for events and maximizing their potential. So why do you see there being such a gulf between how runners train in Ethiopia versus how runners prefer to train over here?
That's such a good question. I think we have kind of this very individualistic sort of notion that comes basically from sports science, this idea that we're kind of, you can take an individual body and submit it to these kinds of input output testing and then kind of come up with this extremely kind of individualized training program that will be best for that one person. In Ethiopia, people don't undergo any of that kind of testing, really. They wouldn't know their kind of lactic threshold, anything like that. And I suppose they all know to a certain degree what kind of pace they're going to have to run to be competitive and to actually make money and, you know, be able to run well in the races that they want to run in. So they don't actually have that much of a choice about what kind of pace they're training at or kind of what they all know roughly that they're aiming to try to get down to sort of 2:06, 2:07 for a marathon or even quicker. Mm. So you can effectively write a training program to do that. And then everybody tries to follow it more or less. But I think there's also a sense that we, you know, that kind of notion that everybody is unique and needs a completely unique training program that's crafted exactly to them also, that allows you to sell a lot of stuff to people as well. So a lot of the new, you know, the kinds of things that runners start to use in terms of like GPS watches, yep, in terms of things that measure HRV and, you know, even things like, I guess, Super Sapiens, things like that. They're all predicated on this notion that you're unique and you need to have these insights into just you that you can then apply to your training. So I suppose we're also pushed in that direction by capitalism generally. But in Ethiopia, there's just more of a sense that you need other people in order to be able to run at that level. And I guess at the highest level, I suppose in the States as well, it's the same, right? You have the kind of training groups with where people probably have a more communal idea of what success is and the importance of being in that kind of environment. I suppose people who've got less time to train do need to, by necessity, have to train alone a lot more as well. That's part of it.
There's a great quote in the book that I want to read off here because I think it's relevant to what you just said. Quote, "Disenchantment is the distinctive injury of modernity. Many of us in the West believe that there are no mysterious, incalculable forces that come into play, but rather that one can, in principle, master all things by calculation." And I think you were talking in that section about how in the West, we're incredibly aware of our limits or our perceived limits. And in Ethiopia and other parts of the world, there's a lot more mystery about what can possibly be attained as an athlete. And I think you say a lot of it is about training intuitively, training creatively, taking an adventurous approach. Can you just talk about that whole section more? Because I was just so impressed by that observation.
Yeah, I think elsewhere I also say it's like it's not only to do with kind of lung capacity, but it's also about kind of cultivating this capacity to dream, yep, and to like to think that you might one day succeed.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that also comes down to sort of religious beliefs as well in Ethiopia, that Orthodox Christians often believe that you need to sort of work hard and be diligent and kind of be quite patient in your work, and that may or may not at some point be rewarded by God. So the idea is that you never really quite know whether it's going to be God's plan to just suddenly elevate you up to being, in the case of a marathon runner, somebody who can win a race like Dubai. So they have this far more open sense of what their possibilities might be. But it meant that I would meet, you know, most people's, even if they didn't seem like they were that good an athlete, they still had this like idea in the back of their mind that maybe if they did the right thing and trained in the right way for a certain amount of time, that they would be able to transform themselves into an athlete of that kind of caliber. So people talked about training as adaptation. They saw the process of training as being quite malleable, and that anybody could adapt given the right circumstances to being a kind of 2:06 marathon runner. It was all about just putting yourself in the environment that would allow you to make those adaptations. So I think that notion of what improvement is as an athlete doesn't really have much space for an idea that you are kind of bound by a certain set of limits, that whether that's, you know, lactic threshold or VO2 max or anything else.
I'm curious what your initial reaction and long-term reaction has been to their de-emphasis of genetic potential, because I just read a book, for example, David Epstein's The Sports Gene, where, you know, every single chapter is just sort of an homage to all of these innate factors. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, siding more with the nature side of the nature versus nurture debate. So did you feel like, after experiencing all of this culturally and being in the trenches with them, that they're on to something when it comes to de-emphasizing that part of human nature? And that at the end of the day, if you are liberated from that mindset or maybe the science of it all, that you actually can go further than you thought you could?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some way they kind of do buy into that sort of idea as well. So people would talk about, but they wouldn't talk about certain genetic kind of adaptations necessarily, but they would talk about the special air in parts of Addis Ababa and the surrounding area and up in the highlands where we went to train as giving them a kind of particular advantage. And I think that the belief that they had, the belief in that advantage is almost as important, I think, as the actual advantage itself, if there is an advantage, because it meant that they thought that when they went to sea level that they were better than everybody else. So that kind of helps.
Yeah.
But most of the genetic research, I mean, they've never really managed to isolate genes that they've been able to prove are associated with athletic performance. There's been so many attempts to do that, and it's never really actually been proven. You know, we just because Jakob Ingebrigtsen can run so fast, we don't assume that he's, that, you know, Norwegian people are sort of genetically gifted in a particular way. So I think there's problems there. And as I said before, you know, there's so many people running at that sort of, at the level that somebody like Jakob is training at in Ethiopia, that it doesn't, that it makes sense that there are more people who are able to run that quick who come from there. But I don't rule out that there are genetic adaptations or kind of altitude advantages in Ethiopia. It's just that as a social anthropologist, I'm not equipped to study them.
Gotcha.
Well, what I can do is kind of give a picture of the kind of cultural factors, I suppose, in their success. But I do think, I mean, I personally think that they're more important than the sports gene kind of interpretations.
As you've heard me speak about before, adding AG1 to my daily routine has been the best thing I've done all year. I have more energy and focus with less caffeine, I have fewer stomach issues from too much coffee, and overall, I feel healthier. It's been a game changer for me this year. However, I will admit, while I had been thinking about trying AG1 for a while, I kept putting it off because of the cost. The initial price tag looks hefty, $77 for a month's supply. That seems like a lot to commit. But when I broke it down in my head, I realized that's only $2.50 per serving. That $2.50 per serving seems even cheaper now that I've seen the benefits. I'm no longer taking a multivitamin, since AG1 has all the nutrients and minerals except in more real food form, so that knocked out about $1 per day. Plus, I'm drinking much less coffee and don't feel quite as guilty for not always having my fridge stocked with fresh greens, so that knocks off another dollar or two. So basically, it's costing me an extra 50 cents compared to my old routine. 50 cents for all the amazing health benefits, how great I feel, and the unique ingredients is easily worth the price. If you've been thinking about trying AG1 as well, but the price kept holding you back, AG1 has made it an even better deal for Run to the Top listeners by giving you a year's worth supply of vitamin D plus 5 travel packs when you use the link athleticgreens.com/RTTT. They even have a money-back guarantee if you don't love it. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/RTTT to get a year's supply of vitamin D and 5 travel packs plus a money-back guarantee. You mentioned that in this culture, high performance and enjoyment of running are not mutually exclusive. Like, these runners can still achieve without sacrificing what drew them to the sport in the first place. What's their secret there? Like, how do they make this possible? Because I think there's a lot of people that feel like they have to sort of sell themselves down the river, and they have to become sort of monomaniacal and robotic in order to get the most out of their bodies and their spirit.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it relates to the what we were talking about before, I suppose, about this notion that everything becomes super like individualized and becomes about the numbers, I guess, in high performance sports. So I think that's sometimes what people find a bit dehumanizing about sport at the very elite level, is it becomes about, you know, granular tracking of particular kind of metrics and then constant lab testing, and it's easy to start to feel a little bit like a machine, I suppose, if you're in that kind of high performance environment. So what I'm trying to say is, in Ethiopia, they're performing at very much the highest level that there is to perform at, without any of those kinds of interventions. But they were also, I think what's interesting is a lot of athletes, endurance runners, for example, in the UK, they wouldn't see their primary motivation for running as being economic, to make money. Whereas in Ethiopia, because I think a lot of people say, you know, that I wouldn't be running like this if it wasn't for the, you know, vague chance of making a life-changing amount of money. What it means is that they're then therefore very, they're kind of aware that running can be quite boring sometimes already, and that they're doing it for a particular reason. And therefore they're constantly trying to think of loads of ways of making it more interesting and more fun, because they're aware of it as a potential source of boredom from the start. So that's, and I think some of the communal running as well, that's also a way of making it more fun and more enjoyable. So they'll, you know, we'll meet up in the morning at 5:45. It'll be a different person leading the run each day. People would deliberately try and find the most ridiculous route through the forest that they could find in order, I think, to keep things interesting. So we would kind of weave in and out of trees in the forest. We'd run up slopes that were kind of so steep that we'd be kind of pulling ourselves up with our hands on tree roots sometimes. You'd have guys who would go and look for the hyenas in the forest just to kind of have something interesting happen on a run. And then we would do things sometimes like get up at 3 a.m. to go and do hill reps. And I think a lot of these things were to do with, you know, I don't think many sports scientists would suggest getting up in the middle of the night to go and run up and down a hill, but there was like a certain kind of power that they felt they derived from that, from doing something a bit different, from doing something that was creative or adventurous, that was seen as having a kind of power in its own right, I think.
We talked to a lot of high-performing athletes on this show, based in the United States in particular, and a lot of them want to hedge their running careers, I would say, where it's something that they do outside of like a traditional 9-to-5. And, you know, they try to get that Olympic trials qualify, for example. They try to, you know, push their limits, all in the context of having like a discrete working life and then also having this running piece. And I was struck by how in this book, so many of these runners were seeing this all-encompassing committed lifestyle as being essential. They had to be completely dedicated to the craft in order to be changed. And maybe most interesting to me is how much they embrace downtime, how much they embrace energy conservation. They trust their minds to hold back when they need to hold back. And I think there's such a fear in the West that if you're left to your own devices, if you go all in as a runner, that you're just going to get injured. You're just going to burn out really quickly. So it's more of a comment, but do you have any thoughts on those two differences there as well?
So people would see, they definitely describe running as their job. That was like, I'm a runner and that's my work. And it's, as you say, completely all encompassing. So to give you kind of an average day, in the life of one of these guys, it would be getting up at, 4:30 a.m, getting on a bus, going somewhere outside of the city to train, coming back at maybe 10:30, 11:00 a.m, eating, then sleeping for maybe 3 or 4 hours, running again, and then eating, and then going to bed at like 9:00. It was like, so for them, it's very clearly no time in the day to do anything apart from running and to focus on running. One of the things that was interesting was that because I was obviously researching my PhD while I was in Ethiopia, as well as training, I would train in the morning, and then I'd usually be going off to, you know, interview somebody or type up field notes and things like that in the afternoon. And there were guys who said, you know, once you've done this, got this PhD out of the way, come back and just do exactly what we do and sleep when we sleep and don't think about writing a book or anything. And you could run 2:09, 2:08, something like that. And this is bearing in mind that, you know, I've run 2:20. That seems to be my limit. They seriously thought that if I made those lifestyle changes, it would make that kind of difference. Like, not sure it would have done, but yeah, it's interesting. I guess I don't know enough about all the different American distance runners to know, but I think probably the top ones are all completely full-time, right?
A lot of them are. Yeah. And they'll be affiliated. And also, to their credit, they will be affiliated with, you know, co-located training groups as well, like the Hansen's Distance Project. You know, the list goes on. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it depends. I think a lot of it depends on the individual as well. I remember I talked to Charlie Spedding about this, who was the last British gold medalist, last British medalist in the Olympic marathon in the '80s. And he said he went, when he went fully pro for a year, he just trained like 3 times a day, did too much. And he actually preferred having the structure of having a job and training around it. So I guess some of it is kind of individual, comes down to individual difference as well. But they definitely, in Ethiopia, it was definitely the case that they thought that to be a truly elite athlete, it had to be all you were doing.
There is an interesting history of amateurism in the US too. Like, I mean, Bill Rogers is a famous example of, like, he was a teacher, and, you know, he would run commute as a significant part of his training to work each day to get the miles in each week. And you know, he reached the height of the sport back in the 70s here. A couple more questions. Another thing that struck me in this book is the Ethiopian reaction to success. And you talk about how a lot of them wear their ambition, quote, lightly in these moments of, you know, breakthrough and success on the highest stages. Why is that the case?
It's largely down to religious belief, basically. So as I was saying before, there's this sense that for the Orthodox Christians, at least, who were most of the guys in the group that I was in were Orthodox Christians, they tended to believe that God had a plan for how their life was going to unfold, which meant that, if they won a race, they would take that quite lightly. But also if the opposite happened, so if I went to races with guys quite frequently and, you know, went to Istanbul to run a race with them, went to China to run races. And if people just, you know, you'd get people who would DNF after 10K, and I'd expect them to be totally, you know, in despair, or at least quite upset having trained for it for 4 months. And they would just be like, well, no, it wasn't my day today. It's clearly like the plan isn't for it to happen today. It's for it to happen at some other point. So psychologically it was, and so the group that I was with were all represented by a manager, a European manager. And he would find that kind of reaction quite frustrating, having gone to having organized the race for them, got a visa, all this kind of stuff. But it was just, they had a sense of, you know, you prepare as well as you can, you do your best in the race, but you there's only so much control that you have personally over what happens, because they more or less all believed that it was kind of God at the end of the day had the final say on what would happen.
I think the last question I have for you, obviously you were there for at least 15 months from what I gather from the book. Embedded training with them, understanding the culture, et cetera. How have you personally in your running life been influenced by their environment and their philosophy? Like, what are the things that you took back with you to the UK? Because you're an accomplished runner yourself. And so I think this is an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. One of the things that I did when I came back from Ethiopia was I asked, the coach there to write me a training plan that I could use in the UK. And what was interesting about that was that it came, the first thing on each of the training sessions was the surface that he wanted me to run on. So that was this kind of idea that you work by the environments first and then think about the training sessions next, I suppose. So when I was following his training program, I ended up doing tons of running on golf courses in Edinburgh, because that was the, that kind of, was the environment that most closely mimics the kind of surface that we would be doing most of the easy running on in Ethiopia. So I was kind of ended up having to dodge golf balls a lot of the time following that training program. But more generally, I think you've got a very, very big polarization in Ethiopia between the easy runs and the rest of the training. So easy runs sometimes were, you know, 8 minutes per kilometer, 9 minutes per kilometer through the forests. And this is for guys who are racing at, you know, under 3 minutes per kilometer. So, to this idea that you've got to take the easy sessions incredibly easy to do well. Unfortunately, with the kind of group training thing, I do think that's like, you know, really one of the most important things over there. That's not been possible really to replicate back in the UK because there's not many places that have, you know, even 5 220 marathon runners in the same place. So it's harder to replicate that kind of thing. But I think more generally, just, I guess what I was talking about in terms of people embracing this more creative kind of adventurous side to their running, it's just that it's really reminded me to, that there's not really much point in making running miserable. So to just try and come up with interesting new training sessions as often as possible. Not necessarily running up and down a hill at 3 a.m, but at least kind of, you know, mixing things up and trying to come up with sessions that actually make you feel kind of excited 2 or 3 days in advance that you've kind of come up with this thing and not just get stuck in this habit of kind of doing the same thing over and over again and becoming bored and disillusioned, I guess.
Right on. Well, Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat. Great to have you on the show. The book is called Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. We'll make sure to link to it in the show notes, as well as the rest of your social media. Is there anything that you want to leave the listeners with in terms of final thoughts or calls to action before we go?
No, I don't think so. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast. I'm your host, Finn Melanson. As always, our mission here is to help you become a better runner with every episode. Please consider connecting with me on Instagram at WasatchFinn and the rest of our team at Runners Connect. Also, consider supporting our show for free with a rating on the Spotify and Apple podcast players. And lastly, if you love the show and want bonus content, behind-the-scenes experiences with our guests, and premier access to contests and giveaways, then subscribe to our newsletter by going to runnersconnect.net/podcast. Until next time, happy training.